DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. This week on the show, after Solingen, how a horrific knife attack is being instrumentalized by the AfD.
This is something that is already affecting the political debate leading up to those two regional elections. And the big question that is being asked here in Germany is to what extent the far-right alternative for Germany will be able to gain or not from this increased political debate around migration.
Still missing? Could blood samples help identify around 2,000 unclaimed bodies in Bosnia and Herzegovina? And arms race in the Caucasus? Could Armenia become the world's next battleground? That's all here on Inside Europe. Last Friday, in the small town of Solingen, not so far from Düsseldorf where I live, the city's 650th anniversary celebrations, held under the motto Festival of Diversity, became the scene of a bloodbath as an assailant with a knife started stabbing those around him, killing three people and leaving eight critically injured. Claimed by the so-called Islamic State, it is an attack with far-reaching political consequences across the country, from Solingen in the west of Germany to Thuringia and Saxony in the east, where crucial regional elections are being held this Sunday. I spoke to our political correspondent, Thomas Sparrow, who has been following the story and its aftermath.
Three people were killed, several others were injured. After that, it took authorities around 24 hours to actually find the man responsible, or at least alleged to be responsible for these killings. In the meantime, the so-called Islamic State terror organization claimed responsibility for the attack without providing evidence. And when the man was arrested, it turned out that he was a 26-year-old Syrian who had arrived to Germany in December 2022, who had applied for asylum, had got something what in Germany is called a subsidiary protection status. And basically what this essentially means is that on the one hand, you have a whole discussion about terrorism now in the country, about terror attacks, about the so-called Islamic State. And then on the other hand, you have a big discussion about migration specifically, also about deportations and people arriving from countries like Syria or Afghanistan.
Well, indeed. And as you mentioned, Thomas, even before the identity of the alleged attacker was known, speculation about his ethnic background was rife on social media. When details did become available, they could not have been more explosive. You mentioned that the individual had a protected asylum status, but this had only come about because a previous attempt to remove him to Bulgaria, which had been his first port of entry into the EU, had not only failed, but then not been followed up on, and the legal deadline under which it could still have been carried out had been allowed to pass.
And this is opening a whole series of very difficult questions. So on the one hand, you mentioned already the fact that authorities actually failed to deport him. On the other hand, there's now a political discussion here in Germany about what exactly should be done with asylum seekers that come to the country, that then apply for these kinds of protected status, that then end up being basically affected by all this German bureaucracy. And what happens in the meantime? So there's also a question about maybe radicalization and how this alleged perpetrator became radicalized. And that's basically why you have now a discussion specifically on the topic of migration focused on the areas of asylum and deportation. So whereas the government has stressed that it is planning to deport failed asylum seekers faster, the opposition has actually been stressing that much more needs to be done. And in fact, the leader of the main opposition party, the CDU-CSU bloc, so Friedrich Merz, specifically requested that Germany should stop actually receiving migrants that come from countries like Syria or Afghanistan. And some other politicians from the CDU, in fact, talking to us, to DW News, basically described the issue of knife crime in the country as an imported problem, as something that comes with migrants. You can imagine that this is extremely controversial. Politicians from other parties would disagree with this idea. In fact, the German government has stressed that the majority of immigrants residing in Germany are not at all related to any criminal offences. But from the opposition point of view here in Germany, the conservative opposition and also even the far-right opposition, the AfD, they're clearly linking crime in Germany, violent crime in Germany, and now also basically terror in Germany to the arrival of migrants to the country.
And of course, this couldn't have come at a more sensitive time, because on Sunday, we have two crucial regional elections taking place in the eastern states of Thuringia and Saxony. Can you set out for me what is at stake?
It's important that we're linking these two topics. So what happened in Solingen, on the other hand, with the upcoming regional election in those two eastern German states, because one of the big topics actually in those two eastern German states was already, before the attack in Solingen, the issue of migration. And now, with the attack in Solingen, with the debate that has come in the last few days, with this whole discussion about whether criminal offences in Germany are linked to migrants or not linked to migrants, which again depends on the statistics and how you look at them, this is something that is already affecting the political debate leading up to those two regional elections. And the big question that is being asked here in Germany is to what extent the far-right alternative for Germany, which is very strong in those two eastern states, will be able to gain or not from this increased political debate around migration. Just to give you an idea, in Thuringia, the AfD is polling around 30%. In Saxony, it's polling around 32%. There is a possibility, although a lot can happen when people actually go to deposit their votes, but there is a possibility that the AfD could end up in first place in both states. This would not mean, and that has to do with Germany's political system, that they would automatically then govern in those two regions, but it would mean that they would have considerable political influence, and a political influence that would undoubtedly move the political debate towards the far right. So this is why many here in Germany are worried about this.
Could you game it out for me, Thomas? In that scenario, the one where the AfD does come out as clearly the strongest party in both Thuringia and Saxony, what happens then?
Basically, all other parties have indicated that they would not, or at least most other parties have indicated that they would not want to work with the AfD. The goal of most other parties is to try and prevent the AfD from forming a coalition government. So that's why the analysis is, even though the AfD might end up in first place, that doesn't necessarily guarantee that the AfD will end up governing in these two regions. And if you look at how the other parties are performing, you will see in both states that the three parties that form the federal government here in Berlin, so the Social Democrats, the Greens and the Liberal FDP, are really having a very bad time. The SPD is polling in both states at around 6%. The Greens at around 3, 4, 5%, the FDP even worse than that. So it basically can be understood in both states as voters punishing what they see is a government that is not very good from their view here in Berlin. So it leaves basically three parties in both states to try and form a coalition. One of them is the AfD. And as I said, other parties are not necessarily interested in working with the AfD. So it leaves the CDU, so the Conservatives on the one hand, and then on the other hand, a relatively newcomer, that is the Bündnis Sarah Wagenknecht, so an alliance, the alliance of Sarah Wagenknecht, Sarah Wagenknecht being a politician who was previously a member of the left and who basically left the left and formed her own party. And interestingly enough, the Bündnis Sarah Wagenknecht, at least in Thuringia, is polling at around 20% and in Saxony around 15%. So it's basically the party that everyone would need to, in one way or another, work with to form a coalition. Interestingly, the Bündnis Sarah Wagenknecht has a rather unusual political mix, because on the one hand, it professes left-wing economic policy proposals, but on the other hand, it combines that with anti-immigrant rhetoric. So, as you can see, a very complex political structure, and a very complex political structure that will also mean that forming coalitions will be very difficult indeed.
Right, and just as an aside, there's a little irony here in that the CDU is in a pickle of its own making, because its line has always been that it won't go into coalition with either the AfD on the far right or Die Linke on the far left. But now it may be forced to go into coalition with Bundessache Wagenknecht, which on a whole host of issues has positions that are much more extreme than Die Linke ever were. As for the three parties that form Germany's governing coalition, they are facing electoral oblivion on a regional level. What could the consequences of these regional elections be for Germany as a whole?
There are two elements that I would highlight. One is, even though we're talking about regional elections in Germany, so elections that are only going to take place in Thuringia and in Saxony, the implications of regional elections in Germany are always national. So basically, it's not only about politicians that have a seat in Saxony or in Thuringia that are now concerned about possible results in one way or another. The federal government and politicians sitting here in Berlin are looking very carefully at what's happening in Thuringia and Saxony, because again, the impact is national. The impact is felt beyond those two states. And the second element is that the federal government here in Berlin under Chancellor Olaf Scholz is not very popular, and it hasn't been very popular for a very long time. There's been internal squabbling. They've had all sorts of internal debates and issues that they have to deal with. They are seen as not being particularly effective. And if on top of that, you have two regional elections where they face, as you describe, a wipeout, where they have terrible results, this will only increase pressure on the federal government for them to change course in some way or another, for them to understand that basically something has to change. And we must not forget that we're now talking about two regional elections, but next year we have the federal elections here in Germany. So basically, already politicians at a local regional level, but more importantly, here in Berlin at a federal level, are already looking at what these elections could actually mean if you extrapolate all these issues to what could happen in 2025 when Germans go to the polls.
Thomas Sparrow in Berlin, thank you very much for talking to me.
Always a pleasure, Kate.
Our political correspondent, Thomas Sparrow, there. We will, of course, be covering the crucial elections in Thuringia and Saxony in next week's programme. Make sure that you're subscribed to our podcast so that you don't miss it. Now, Friday, August 30th marks the International Day of the Disappeared. And in Bosnia and Herzegovina, it's another reason to stop and think about the thousands of people who are still missing following the war of the 1990s. With almost 2,000 bodies still lying unclaimed in the country's mortuaries, the authorities recently launched a new appeal for blood samples in an effort to identify the remains. Our Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay, reflects on what the issue means for Bosnia and its people.
Every summer, a few more victims of the Srebrenica massacre are laid to rest. This year, 14 people were buried in a ceremony at Potocari Cemetery, close to the site of the atrocity. It's almost 30 years since Bosnian Serb forces systematically murdered around 8,000 Bosniak Muslim men and boys. But even now, the remains of around 800 of those victims have yet to be identified.
Not to have that place where you can pay a tribute to your loved ones, it is really, really, really hard.
Mirela Osmanovic works at the Srebrenica Memorial Center. Her two teenage brothers, Velid and Akmedin, both died in the massacre 2 years before she was born.
The process of finding their bones and accepting what have happened, what was committed, was a really long process.
You were able to find your brothers, you were able to give them a burial. What did that mean for your family then?
Until that moment, they were hoping that someone will knock out of our door and say, hey, we found them, they are alive somewhere. We have buried one of my brothers in 2006 and another one in 2008. Even today, like almost 30 years after the genocide, we have families that didn't find their loved ones.
This is where some of the work to change that is taking place. Workers in Visakor mortuary sift through human remains to extract DNA samples and find any physical clues that could help to identify who these people might have been. It's grim, painstaking work, but it may help to match some of the unclaimed remains with families desperate to find their relatives.
Bosnia has done a lot, but nevertheless, approximately 7,000 persons remain missing from the Bosnian conflict.
Matthew Holliday is the programme director in Europe for ICMP, the International Commission on Missing Persons. His organisation is taking part in a new blood testing campaign to ensure remains have been identified accurately.
This issue of misidentification that occurred when DNA was not used as the primary means of or method of identification, which then has this knock-on legacy or consequence of large numbers of unidentified remains in the mortuaries.
How do you work with the families when it is such a sensitive issue?
We talk them and walk them through all of the DNA process. If you provide blood, then you can only help another family resolve potentially their missing person's case. But also, if you provide blood, you may actually find that your relative is actually sitting on a rack in a certain mortuary. Wouldn't you actually rather know that and have your relative correctly identified and buried?
The drive to obtain blood samples offers hope for thousands of families who remain in the dark. Zhekia Avdibegovic chairs a missing persons association in the town of Ilyash. She's still hoping for news of her husband, son, and seven other family members.
Honestly speaking, it's an extremely difficult process, and we have the case where a father and a son, basically their identities were mistaken, and the father was buried instead of a son and son instead of father, and we had to correct this, and it was painful. Even in that case, it is our whole life is painful, I have to say. The purpose of our whole life is just to learn about the fate and whereabouts of our loved ones and to bury them properly. But as the time goes by, we somehow begin to doubt whether we will ever be able to locate them.
The annual commemorations will continue, but everybody acknowledges that the odds of solving all the missing persons' cases are low, and with ever fewer people alive to provide the all-important blood samples, time is running out. Guy Delorne, DW, Sarajevo.
Just a quick reminder here that our feedback address is insideeurope@dw.com. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. With the war between Russia and Ukraine still raging, could a new conflict now be brewing on Europe's eastern border? Armenia and Azerbaijan have clashed on and off for decades, mainly over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave. Now, both countries are rearming, with France and Germany backing Armenia and Turkey supporting Azerbaijan. Fears of a growing arms race are threatening to overshadow ongoing US-backed peace talks and, as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, raising the prospect of a new conflict.
Azerbaijan displayed its vast array of military hardware in a parade through the capital, Baku, after last year's successful recapturing of the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave from Armenian-backed forces. Oil-rich Azerbaijan is now pledging to build on its military success by continuing its rearmament program, depending heavily on Turkey's arms industry. Hüseyin Barca is a professor of international relations at Ankara's Middle East Technical University and says Turkey is ready to meet Azerbaijan's military needs, but says it's not just Turkish arms that Azerbaijan depends on.
the Turkish defense industry and the Turkish military equipment will be provided further to protect Azerbaijan, but Israel is much better in this respect than Turkey, because Azerbaijan buys the highest technology from Israel.
Turkish and Israeli arms were crucial for Azerbaijan overwhelming Armenian-backed forces in Nagorno-Karabakh, which relied on Russian arms, some dating back to the Soviet era. But in the wake of that defeat, Yerevan is rearming with European support, including Germany and France, which are at the forefront of supplying new weapons, including state-of-the-art artillery. Paris argues such support is key to helping Armenia pivot towards the West and away from its past reliance on Russia militarily and diplomatically. Last month, the United States held major military joint exercises with Armenia as part of growing efforts of dragging Armenia away from the Russian sphere of influence. But Yerevan insists its military modernization is only for self-defense. Eric Hachopian is a political consultant in Armenia.
Right now, there's no military parity between Armenia and Azerbaijan. The goal is to create deterrence in the short run to make any aggression against Armenia far more costly than it has been in the past. Two is to create equality in the middle term and in the long term, superiority. So that's that you can't have any other goal. When your country is constantly under threat or attack, it's the only way to respond to it.
The rearmament comes as US-backed Armenian and Azerbaijani peace talks are continuing, but remain stalled over ongoing territorial disputes. Baku is now voicing concern that Yerevan's rearmament could signal ambitions to recapture the Nagorno-Karabakh enclave. Farid Shafiev is the chairman of the Baku-based Center for Analysis of International Relations.
The truth is our territory was under occupation. So we were worried that, you know, in 5-10 years, Armenia would rearm its military, strengthen military capacities, and will come back. Because some Armenians, even I've been told by some experts, they said, okay, we lost the war, but we won the first war, we lost the second. So in 10, 15, 20 years, we'll come back to this issue. We're referring that maybe in 20 years, Azerbaijan will run out of oil and other resources and will be weaker.
Yerevan insists its rearming is part of a policy of peace through strength against the threat posed by Azerbaijan's growing military might and its increasingly assertive president, Ilham Aliyev. However, Armenian analyst Eric Hachopian acknowledges that the coming year will be dangerous as Yerevan seeks to close the military gap with Azerbaijan.
There's a time clock. The time clock is the moment that Armenia can defend itself, then the game is up, because Ilham Aliyev is not going to risk a war that he's not guaranteed to win. Armenia rearming means that he's not guaranteed to win a war, which means he won't launch one. Next year is the year of living dangerously, because next year is probably the last year that they can do a major aggression against Armenia without having to fear the consequences. The gap is closing, and once it closes, the game is up.
Armenia and Azerbaijan claim they remain committed to US-backed peace efforts. However, the ongoing arms build-up can only exacerbate mutual suspicions, further complicating peace efforts. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
We are a publicly funded programme, so we will never ask you for money. But if you would like to support our journalism, there is one thing you can do for us. Leave us a 5-star rating on your podcast app, or even better, recommend us to a friend. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe.
Thank you.
You're listening to Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock, in Germany. Now, two stories have been sending shockwaves around the tech world in the last couple of weeks. First, there was the dramatic sinking of a luxury yacht off the coast of Sicily, killing British cybersecurity entrepreneur Mike Lynch and six other passengers. Then, last Saturday, came the surprise arrest in Paris of Pavel Durov, the glamorous and globe-trotting founder of the Russian messaging app Telegram. We'll have more on both stories for you in just a minute, followed by an in-depth look at our right to repair.
I can imagine that this is at least 30 or 40 years old, probably. Actually, the ones that are made to be repaired. So you can see inside is almost no plastic. Everything is metal. It's quite heavy.
There's no built-in obsolescence in this show, so do stay tuned.
From Bonn, Germany, you're listening to Inside Europe.
After the drowning of seven people on a luxury yacht off the coast of Sicily in mid-August, an Italian prosecutor has opened a manslaughter investigation into the deaths. The case has caught global attention, not least because the victims included the ship's owner, Mike Lynch, a British tech entrepreneur recently acquitted in a multi-billion dollar fraud case, whose co-defendant in the trial, Stephen Chamberlain, had been fatally struck by a car 2 days earlier. To make matters more piquant, Chamberlain had also been the chief operating officer of Darktrace, a cybersecurity firm co-founded by Lynch, which listed the former director general of the British Security Services and the CIA's former director of security amongst its advisory board. So far, so homeland. But this is Inside Europe. So what we want to know is, what's the view from Italy, where investigations are likely to focus on what role human error might have played in the sinking of the state-of-the-art sailing vessel? Over to our reporter, Megan Williams.
Residents of the Sicilian port town Ponticello hold a procession to commemorate the seven victims of the Bayesian luxury yacht that sank suddenly off the coast of Sicily on August 19th. Carrying candles and setting bouquets of flowers afloat in the water. A week after the capsize that took the life of six passengers and the chef, Italian prosecutor Ambrogio Cortosio of nearby Termini Imerese announced a general investigation into the drowning deaths.
Vi comunico ufficialmente che la Procura della Repubblica di Termini.
He said it was, quote, plausible that crimes of multiple manslaughter and causing a shipwreck through negligence had been committed. Several days later, news came that 51-year-old captain, New Zealander James Cutfield, the ship's engineer Tim Parker Eaton, and sailor Matthew Griffin had all been placed under investigation. What investigators will be focusing on, say experts, is human error. As divers retrieved the bodies from the wreck, details of what happened began to emerge. The Bayesian, a more than 50-meter-long luxury yacht with a British flag, had been anchored off the port of Porticello, near Palermo, when, early in the morning on August 19th, it was hit by an unusual tornado-like weather event known as a downburst. Witnesses say the vessel sank within minutes, taking with it seven of the 22 on board. The only crew member among the victims, Canadian Antiguan chef Ricardo Thomas, was found the morning of the capsize. The ship lay on its side 50 meters underwater, making it complicated for divers to reach the bodies of the others, including British tech billionaire Mike Lynch and his daughter Hannah, whose bodies were retrieved days later.
All'interno lo scenario era molto simile perché immaginiamo di.
We found the six bodies in the upper cabins on the left side, the side that faced the surface, said head of the rescue team Girolamo Bentivoglio Fiandra.
Erano tutti corpi incastrati perché parliamo di un relitto.
It's clear, he said, that people were trying to escape, looking for air bubbles that had formed in the upper cabins. The question of how people died is fairly clear, say experts. What is far less clear, though, is how the state-of-the-art ship could have filled up with enough water to cause it to sink in just minutes. The yacht was built in 2008 by Perini Navi, an Italian luxury yacht maker. It featured the world's tallest aluminum mast. CEO Giovanni Costantino of the Italian Sea Group, which owns the luxury yacht maker Perini, has called the yacht unsinkable, one of the safest boats in the world. Based on partial data, he says he believes human error was likely the cause, with the crew possibly failing to shut all doors and hatches or fully lower the keel, among other oversights.
C'è stata, diciamo, un'escursione a tappeto di tutti i membri dell'equipaggio.
Prosecutors say it's too early to comment on causes. And among the questions remaining is why authorities did not immediately test surviving crew members for alcohol or drugs, despite their explanation that they failed to do so because people were in a state of shock. There are also questions as to why all crew members, except for the chef, were able to save themselves while passengers remained trapped inside. Before the investigation narrowed to focus on Captain James Cutfield, the New Zealander, who lives in Spain, was questioned twice at length about the capsize. He is now exercising his right to remain silent. His lawyer says he's worn out and that they need to see more data from the capsize for a proper defense. Authorities say the investigation, including raising the ship to the surface and performing autopsy on the victims, could last weeks. Megan Williams, DW, Rome.
Now to our second story this half hour, one with a very different tech figure at its centre, Pavel Durov, the 39-year-old founder of the popular messaging app Telegram. In a shock move, French authorities arrested Durov as he landed at a Paris airport last Saturday, indicting him on Wednesday on numerous criminal charges connected to the distribution of child sexual abuse material, selling narcotics, fraud and money laundering. In other words, all the illicit stuff that passes through Telegram channels. In a separate case, French agencies are reporting that Durov is also being investigated for alleged violence against one of his own children. It's a story that has set the technosphere a jitter. And to unpack it all, I turned to Cyrus Farivar, former DW science editor, long-term tech watcher, and now a senior writer at Forbes magazine. Just what is Telegram and why is it such a big deal, I asked him.
Telegram is an app that many people use around the world. It's particularly popular within Russia and amongst some of the former Soviet countries and in Ukraine and some other neighboring countries as well. Also in places around the world like Iran, where internet access is not freely available or is restricted in some way. It's a messaging app similar to WhatsApp, similar to Signal, other types of messaging applications. But I would say it's different in a critical way, which is to say that it's been historically very lax in terms of the kinds of content that it allows on its platform. Unlike WhatsApp, unlike Signal, unlike, I would say, just about every other mainstream messaging app, it is a bit more freewheeling. It's a bit more kind of anything goes. American federal law enforcement have said recently that it is generally not responsive to the demands of American law enforcement. And I would imagine law enforcement agencies from Europe, from many other places, would agree with that assessment as well.
I just want to read you, if I can, Cyrus, a couple of quotes. So this one is whistleblower Edward Snowden. He said, "The arrest of Durov is an assault on the basic rights of human speech. I'm surprised and deeply saddened that Macron has descended to the level of taking hostages as a means to gaining access to private communications." And then the other one I wanted to read to you was from the founder of Signal, Moxie Marlinspike, and he shared an article published by Politico, which was about the extent to which Macron and his team use Telegram. And he said that Telegram messages are not encrypted. France is trying to arrest the CEO of a Russian team that has plain text access to every message the French president ever sent or received. So very much a sense here, certainly from these two members of the tech community, that there is more at play than the French authorities are saying. What's your sort of take on this spin?
Yeah, I mean, those two gentlemen, Mr. Snowden and Mr. Marlinspike, are saying kind of different things. I think you're right. There's been a little bit of a backlash from some people in the tech community who have benefited from kind of the freewheeling nature of an app like Telegram. It's worth noting also that Mr. Durov, prior to founding Telegram, founded a social network in Russia called VKontakte, which is similar to LinkedIn, which is very popular here in North America and in some parts of Europe as well. It's a kind of a business networking website. But Mr. Durov fled Russia, I think, 10 years ago now, and has kind of bounced around the globe and, you know, kind of sought refuge in different places and reportedly now holds citizenship in the United Arab Emirates, where apparently he lives, in addition to St. Kitts in the Caribbean, and apparently also in France as of, you know, just a few years ago. But I think some of this backlash that you mentioned, I think, comes from really from the fact that there is certainly what we here in the U.S. would call a kind of a libertarian strain. There's a lot of chatter on a place like Telegram for, you know, to talk about things like cryptocurrencies. You know, I myself yesterday went poking around Telegram just to see, you know, very easily what was available. You know, Donald Trump and his supporters are very popular on Telegram. There's chatter of this so-called stop the steal, this kind of false narrative that the 2020 American presidential election was somehow stolen. And that kind of chatter proliferates on Telegram. There are some that believe that, you know, the French government is somehow trying to, you know, stop Telegram or stop Durov himself in some way. I believe that Macron has said that he had nothing to do with Durov's arrest. So I don't know. There's a lot of unanswered questions at this point. You know, it's not every day that a, you know, French billionaire, ex-Russian, gets picked up by French authorities at a Parisian airport.
The Russian use of Telegram is also interesting because it's been widely used by Russian military, for example, for battlefield communications. You've also got the so-called Zed bloggers, pro-war bloggers on there, but you've also got lots of use by anti-regime activists. I mean, do you get a sense of the significance of Telegram in a Russian context?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting. A lot of these tools, even though we may have similar types of tools, right? Asia has WeChat. I think in Europe and many other parts of the world, in Africa and Latin America, I think WhatsApp is very popular. You know, I think every kind of corner of the globe has its popular platform. And certainly in the Russian and Russian-speaking parts of the world, Telegram, probably because I would imagine of Mr. Durov's, you know, national origin and its original popularity in those countries, it's just become what everybody has used to, it seems. I know, you know, even in the early days of the conflict in Ukraine, I know that, you know, some American media outlets started publishing in Telegram as a way to reach a different kind of audience. I'll be honest, I was a little bit surprised to learn that Russian military communications are going through Telegram in some way. That just seems totally wild to me that they wouldn't have a better way to communicate on the battlefield. But, you know, what do I know?
Well, you know a lot, Cyrus. And I mean, this story is it's why I'm talking to you. But I mean,
I guess what I'm saying is, what do I know about Russian battlefield communications? Not very
much.
Oh,
I see. But I mean, you know, as a tech watcher, there are just so many aspects to this story. What are the threads that have really got you interested as you sort of research and dig deeper this week?
I mean, I guess, you know, there's a lot of questions. You know, Mr. Durov himself is very fascinating, right? He's a young entrepreneur. As I said, he fled Russia some years ago, has been kind of bouncing around the world. Recently, he announced on Telegram that he is a very prolific sperm donor and apparently has fathered 100 children. Not totally why he would want to do that, but he seems to believe that that's important, and more power to him, I guess. But, you know, in addition, he seems to take an attitude of running his company in a way that sort of many, again, as we would call them here in the U.S., libertarians would want, you know, a network where all kinds of speech can proliferate, a place where even, you know, near criminal or outright criminal things can be bought, sold, discussed, you know, and so forth. And in many cases, you might be surprised at how easy they are to find. It's just kind of a bonkers platform that you really don't find anywhere close to the same degree as you do on other kinds of messaging apps.
And in the meantime, Mr. Durov himself is incredibly memeable. I do suggest that everybody looks this up. Cyrus, thank you so much for joining me and for taking that deep dive into the world of Telegram.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Cyrus Farivar is a senior staff writer at Forbes magazine, and we'll be linking to his latest piece on this story in our show notes. Don't go away. We're moving on to the hard stuff next. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. By hard stuff, I meant hardware, the actual physical tech gadgets that make our seemingly disembodied digital existence possible. In reality, we generate so much e-waste per year that we could easily fill garbage trucks standing bumper to bumper around the equator. In response, a growing movement of repair enthusiasts and activists is stepping up to extend the life of gadgets and household items. Our colleague Ben Ressler from DW's Living Planet team has been investigating the idea of the right to repair and meeting some of the people who are already making it a reality.
It's a weekday evening at a Berlin repair cafe. Once a month, tech hobbyists meet here to help people fix broken household appliances like toasters and juicers, or electronic equipment like hi-fi amplifiers, CD players, and so on. Anyone can drop in. It's free of charge. The main idea behind repair meetups like these is to extend the lifespan of electrical and electronic equipment so that it doesn't end up as e-waste. In 2022, the world generated a record 62 billion kilograms of the stuff, according to the UN's 2024 Global E-Waste Monitor. An abstract figure, sure. But imagine this. The UN says that's enough e-waste to fill enough garbage trucks to circumnavigate the entire planet. Europe is the biggest producer of e-waste per capita, but also a leader in terms of collection and recycling.
If we compare Europe globally speaking, with many other parts of the world, Europe is a forerunner when it comes to recycling and collection as such. But on average, we are still below 50% of all e-waste generated, what is collected and properly recycled. So it shows there's enormous room for improvement here.
That's Professor Rüdiger Kühr, one of the report's lead authors and a senior manager of the UN's Sustainable Cycles Program, focused on sustainable production, consumption, and disposal. The problem is that since 2010, the amount of e-waste has been growing by almost 2 billion kilograms every year, and most isn't properly collected and recycled. Much of it ends up on unregulated, informal scrapyards in low-income countries.
It's around 5 million tons of e-waste, classified partly as reusable, shipped every year to the southern hemisphere from the northern hemisphere. It's causing a lot of issues there.
Workers break apart old smartphones, computers, and television sets by hand and burn cables to extract valuable resources like copper and gold. But that comes at a cost. E-waste contains hazardous heavy metals like mercury and lead, and toxic flame retardants. They pose major health risks to workers and poison the environment, as Ian Williams explains. He's a professor of applied environmental science at England's University of Southampton.
In places like Lagos, for example, you have perhaps a square mile or more of just utterly contaminated land, where there's nothing but e-waste, you know, crude, basic e-waste recycling going on by informal recyclers, which has utterly destroyed the landscape and is giving people horrendous health problems.
Back at the Berlin Repair Cafe, Someone has brought in a broken sewing machine.
Es ist sehr hart und es sollte zurückkommen. So das heißt, dass wir haben hier auch ein Problem.
Maurizio, one of the volunteers here, is leaning over the large, heavy machine, peering inside. Its lid has been removed. He's an expert in all things sewing machines.
The selector is so strongly blocked by old oil or not the proper oil that you cannot move it freely. So that means we need to disassemble the whole thing, disassemble the axis, clean it, put it back again, and then most probably it will work.
This isn't a new model, far from it, but that might actually be an advantage.
I can imagine that this is at least 30 or 40 years old, probably. Actually, the ones that are made to be repaired. So you can see inside is almost no plastic. Everything is metal. It's quite heavy. But this is also, so what is seen as a disadvantage is actually an advantage in terms of the robustness of the whole mechanism.
He says in his experience, newer machines are often much harder to repair.
In the new machines, it's extremely difficult to open them and to find the places where you have to, for example, to put oil. So these machines are made like not to be opened easily. And if you cannot open, of course you cannot repair.
That's something activists like Stefan Schridder have been criticizing for years. An economist by training, Schridder runs a small Berlin exhibition space showcasing electrical and electronic devices that he says have been built to fail or that are very tricky to repair. It's aptly named Murkseum, which roughly translates to Botch Museum. He gives a little tour and begins by pointing out a black Senseo coffee maker that's almost impossible to fix.
You find no screws, nothing in there, there's just some clips. And if you want to open it, to repair it, you have to break the bottom out. So you have to destroy the machine to repair it. So the way they build it is just to prevent the people to repair the product.
His exhibition space is full of items just like this. Practically unfixable handheld mixers, faulty printers, and much more. Professor Ian Williams encountered exactly such a problem not too long ago. When he tried getting his broken dishwasher fixed, buying a replacement turned out to be the only viable option. It's a very common problem.
Most people will be aware that in recent years, manufacturers have deliberately built products that are designed for replacement, not repair. And of course, they've also encouraged more rapid replacement by putting inbuilt obsolescence into the equipment. So software that slows down over time, making life very difficult, or individual components that are kind of not made to a very high standard because they're relatively cheap and they just need to suit a particular purpose. But as soon as they break, you can't do anything about it. So you end up having to replace an entire item because a small component is gone.
While some devices are too costly or complicated to fix, others are designed with inbuilt repair barriers.
So one of the companies that we often criticize is Apple. Not because they make products which would be completely irreparable in themselves, although some of their products are, but because even those products that are repairable can actually only be repaired within their own ecosystem.
That's Thomas Opsoma of iFixit, a company that publishes repair manuals, sells matching tools, and champions the right to repair.
So they have a very protective stance where only under certain circumstances can you buy parts and so on and so forth. One of the typical issues that we often criticize is so-called parts pairing, where a part is sort of coupled with the device, and if you switch out a genuine part, it will no longer work.
Parts pairing is a software feature that detects whether original or third-party replacement parts have been installed. When third-party components are installed, the software causes problems or the components don't work properly. And that means consumers are forced to get devices fixed by Apple's expensive in-house repair service or by equally expensive authorized Apple dealers. Apple has defended the practice, saying only genuine parts will guarantee its phones will function properly. and says third-party components could also present a security risk. Apple, incidentally, isn't the only company accused of parts pairing. Professor Kür says complicating repairs may have another reason.
Some especially prominent brands are trying to avoid repair or easy repair because they want to control their repair business themselves and take also the margins themselves out of this.
More and more consumers are fed up with this situation and want devices that are straightforward and affordable to fix. Something that iFixit has demanded for years.
So as a right to repair campaign, we advocate for what we call a universal right to repair, which means it's fine if a manufacturer or their authorized representative can repair a product, whether inside or outside of guarantee. But we also feel that an independent repairer should also be able to repair your product, and you should also be able to repair your own product if you're so inclined.
That's echoed by Rini Rapasi, a German member of the European Parliament, who's campaigned extensively for EU right to repair legislation. He was instrumental in the EU's new Right to Repair Directive, which was adopted in April 2024.
Whilst many consumers might want to go for a repair, they meet the challenge of extremely expensive repair because of prices for spare parts that are extremely high, or that products are simply irreparable due to design reasons. And here we, in the Right to Repair, introduce a rule that spare part prices must now be reasonably priced and that barriers of hardware, software, and contractual nature are prohibited so that repair overall becomes more affordable.
The Right to Repair Directive, which EU states have to implement within the next 2 years, stipulates that devices fixed by manufacturers within the legal warranty period gain a 12-month warranty extension. Manufacturers are obliged to fix items even after the warranty has expired. They're obliged to sell spare parts and tools at a reasonable price. And they are banned from complicating repairs through contractual clauses, hardware or software techniques. The directive will also bring into existence an online platform to help consumers find repair shops and meetups, locate sellers of refurbished goods, and buyers of broken devices. The European Commission expects that the directive will help save almost 2 million tons of resources and 3 million tons of waste over the next 15 years. But Thomas Opsommer says the directive is far from perfect, as it only applies to some product categories.
It only covers about a dozen products. So washing machines, dryers, vacuum cleaners, television sets, smartphones, but not the vast majority of products that you would have in your household. So a toaster, a mixer, headphones, they are all not covered by specific regulations and therefore not covered by the right to repair.
He also says the directive doesn't define a reasonable price for spare parts and tools. Even so, there's cause for optimism.
I think that today both right to repair and planned obsolescence have become sort of household names. So I think people are very aware of it.
So we might be seeing many more repair cafes popping up across Europe as consumers opt to reuse and repair instead of buying new.
Ben Restler with that report, originally aired on DW's Living Planet podcast. Now, Europe's repair culture is just one example of movements, projects and people around the continent who are actively bringing about positive change. And we really want to highlight these voices. So if you have any ideas for our ongoing Other Europe series, please do drop us a line at insideeurope@dw.com. That's it for today. This programme was produced by Helen Sini with help from me, Kate Laycock, and sound engineer Gerd Georgi. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.